It's time for Caffeinated Comics, a lively discussion and debate on comics, film, television, and collectibles, all fueled by the magic of Frappuccinos. Caffeinated Comics is sponsored by Chimeras Comics. Chimeras is your one stop for comic books, graphic novels, hero clicks, Magic the Gathering, and more. Explore the fantastic at Chimeras Comics. And now, here's your hosts, John and Steven.
Thank you. This is Caffeinated Comics. I'm your host, John Clark. As you guys know, Stephen Colbert finished a tremendous run of the Colbert Report that lasted over 9 years. And he's about to move to the CBS show. I think most of us are really, really excited about it. And one of the guys that I know who is as excited has been there since the beginning, and that's my friend Mike Brum. Mike started at the Colbert Report about 6 months into its run, and he stayed there till the end, and he is moving on to CBS. I've known Mike since our days in advertising before he got on the Colbert Report, and he was always brilliant. He was always really sweet. He was always affable, and it was great to reconnect with him and find out none of those things have changed. You know, the man has multiple Emmy Awards, and he's moving on to a network show, and he's living his exact dream. But none of that has affected his life. He's, you know, he's gone on. He started a family. He's still very settled. He's still very down to earth. And it was great to talk to him again. And I'm really excited that you guys are going to be able to hear it now.
I'm originally from St. Louis. I went to school at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And it seems like everybody from Urbana-Champaign kind of moves to Chicago, and I just kind of followed my friends there.
Yeah,
I actually had a. When I was in a play at the University of Illinois, we were in Italian-American Reconciliation, and there was this girl, and she goes, "Hey, I'm going to Europe for 3 months. You want to come with me?" And this is my senior year. I said, "Okay." And I didn't really know her at all. And then we were in this play together, and so we went to Europe together for 3 months, and then we kind of found him more. And then, you know, when I got back, I was in St. Louis. I worked at a car wash just because I was trying to make quick money, and the car wash said $7, you know. Like, I go, $7? I can make $7 an hour? That's fantastic. So I got a job there. I made like $65, and I moved to, you know, I borrowed my parents' car and moved up to Chicago.
Where did you live in Chicago originally?
I originally lived in Wrigleyville, pretty much. Roscoe Village, and I forget what the area is called now. It's a little bit north of the Wrigleyville. I forget what the area is, but I lived there with my friends Mike Ross and Brian Fazio. Mm-hmm. And I agreed. They said, "We'll let you come, but for the first 2 months, you don't have to pay rent." And I said, "Okay, that sounds great." And then when I got there, they said, "We don't remember ever saying that." And I go, "Well, I have $65. I have no money." And then they were nice enough not to let me pay rent. So,
wow. And now, were you already interested? As you said, you were doing plays, you were acting. Were you already interested in doing improv when you moved to Chicago? Or did that just kind of discover that? I mean, you're in Wrigleyville, so you know.
Yeah, improv pretty much right actually. I wanted to be a doctor going into college, and then I got like D's in biology and chemistry. And then I started doing improv at the time, and I go, "Oh, you know, something creative would be fun." So I went into advertising, but I was with a group called Spacey Clamato in college. And so, you know, when I got out, I went to Chicago, and everybody did improv there. And I borrowed $50 from my friend Brian Fazio, the guy who let me live in his place for free. And he goes, "I'll give you $50 for your first class." I go, "Okay." And so I took a class at Improv Olympic, and like I immediately fell in love with it. Like, I don't know why. That's all I did, you know, like almost 7 days a week, that's all I did. And I also interned at the Second City before that. And so like a lot of people there, you just kind of eat, sleep, improv. And I did the same thing for a long time.
And how long were you part of – so that's the Second City?
That was not really the Second City. I did intern at Second City, but I only really did improv at Improv Olympic.
Okay.
And that was about maybe 4 years.
And then what led you to New York?
Well, when I was at Improv Olympic, I was working at Blue Cross Blue Shield as from an insurance firm, and then the job came up for Jelly Vision, and Jelly Vision was a game you don't know Jack.
Right.
And I interviewed for there, I got hired there, and that was a really great game. It was a really fun place to work too, and that's where I met Allison Silverman, who used to be the head writer for Colbert, but that's a different story. But anyway, that place was great, but they at one point after 2 years in, they kind of laid everybody off. And so I panicked and I said, grad school. I always wanted to go to grad school, and this was a good excuse to go to grad school. So I always wanted to go to NYU, and there was this program called Media Ecology, and it has no practical application. It's like media and politics and how they mix and how they shouldn't mix or how they do mix. And so I just went to go study that. And that's what led me to New York. But it was pretty much just an excuse to go to New York. I was too scared to come up here just to like follow a dream, because I always did want to write for TV. But I was too scared to admit that to myself. So the only way I could do it was by going to grad school. So I'm still paying off the loans to NYU, but I'm glad I did it, you know.
Right. And so did you complete your degree in grad school?
I did.
Okay.
So I'm a master in media ecology, a program that is now defunct.
But wouldn't it be worse if you had that as an incomplete and it was defunct?
Yeah. That is true.
It would just be this unfinished business. There'd be no way to complete it.
I know, that's true. There's no, I know. And they go, what is that? Why do you even have that? I have no idea.
And you and I met at Wonderman. I didn't realize you did advertising in Chicago as well.
I didn't really do too much advertising. I was in the marketing firm of, it was really like Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance firm. I really did the marketing department, which is pretty much just like a glorified temp. You know, I just kind of like Xerox things or whatever, but it was called the marketing department. So I kind of used it. I just said, I'm sort of an advertiser in the marketing world, but that was pretty much it.
Right.
But yeah, we met at Wonderman. I actually really liked Wonderman. Did you like Wonderman?
I loved Wonderman. Yeah. It was one of my favorite places to work. And now I'm at a point where I've been to, you know, like 10, 12 different agencies, and there's a culture there that you don't find too many other places.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. I worked for my last job. My creative director worked at the Wonderman in Chicago, which is like on Michigan Avenue. And yeah, the stories he had were the same stories we had.
Really?
So, yeah. So, like, Wonderman definitely has a culture and a style. And you don't find that everywhere.
Yeah, you don't. And it was a really great place. I loved it so much. In fact, when I first started with Colbert, I'd say, like, the first month or so, I kept going, like, did I make a mistake? Like, I really miss Wonderman. Like, it was, I had all my friends there and all the people were there. And yeah, I really miss it.
Wow. Yeah. I did not have that problem. Well, we all transferred to Ogilvy, you remember. And it was, at first it was the same because the whole team transferred over. And then slowly but surely we realized that Ogilvy was not Wonderman.
Yeah.
And like, I was there 2 years, and the first year was great, and the second year was not great.
Really?
So it was like, yeah, so it was kind of this ebbing. But, and that's the thing about Wonderman is so many people that we work with, and now I think we're talking about 10 years ago when we worked there.
Yeah, I know.
So many people are still close with.
I know, it's crazy. Know?
Yeah, out of there, you know, we talk a lot about the show, how like places have a moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what Wonderman in like the early to mid 2000s, there were just a lot of great people there.
Yeah, it was a great people, great environment. It was like a lot of fun, and like, yeah, it was great. You know, it was a really good time. Like, and I still see Mark Horn all the time, who lives right up the street from me. But I still see.
Really?
Yeah,
I still talk to I talked to Mark Feigenson. He's expecting his first.
Oh, nice, nice.
And I talked to Rebecca Lloyd. I've had Steve Klausner on the show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, talking about like some of the horror movies he's written.
That's awesome. Oh,
he's
that's great.
He and I wrote 3 or 4 scripts together. We had one was a finalist in a film festival.
Yeah. But
that's as far as we got together. And then I talked to Rebecca Lloyd and Elaine a lot.
Oh, that's like, good. How are they doing?
Oh, they're great. Yeah, Rebecca's family lives out in Wisconsin, so she ends up like visiting once a year or so. She'll stop in Chicago on the way.
Oh, that's
and
great.
Elaine's great. You know, Elaine always lands at her feet. She was on the show too. We had her on talking about technology.
Oh, really? She's awesome.
Yeah, there are some really, really great people. But you were there, so you were at Wonderman. So Wonderman is really your first job being paid as a writer then?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I was a writer. When I did work for You Don't Know Jack, that was a writing job. That was just like
that's true.
Writing irreverent CD-ROM trivia questions. And so Mark saw that. He goes, well, if you can do that, maybe we'll try and advertise. And I put together a quick little portfolio. And you know, he was nice enough to give me a chance. But yeah, it was my first like copywriting job, especially in the big city, you know. And I remember I believe my second day I actually quit. Because
really?
this IBM, yeah, he had me write an IBM brochure. And I was I was just overwhelmed or whatever. So I just said, I quit. And then
I remember that because you know what? I wrote that brochure.
I know.
Because I was given that brochure late and they said, yeah, the guy we asked to write this quit.
Yeah, that was
See, you write it. I was like, all right, I'm not going to quit.
I know that was so – I know. I don't know why. It was just like – it was, you know, it was just text about computers and stuff. I go, I have no idea what this is. I've never done anything like this before. And I took the easy way out and quit. And then I tried – I was actually typing at Google. So I quickly called Google and said, can I have my old job back? And they said, nah, I don't think so. So – but then Mark called me back. He said, why don't you come back in? And I came back in. And it all worked out eventually.
Wow. And how long?
I owe Mark a lot for actually giving me another chance.
Like, yeah, that's two.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was there. I started there in 2000. When were you like 2002? Did you come?
I think 2001. Yeah, I think 2002, late 2002, maybe early 2003.
Okay, yeah, because that was also the move when we went from Chelsea to Madison Avenue.
Yeah, I was only at Madison. I wasn't at Chelsea.
Oh, okay. And you heard what happened with that building, right?
No, is that what? Well, I know somebody was killed in an elevator.
Yeah, yeah. Those elevators, they used to take like 10 minutes.
Yeah,
like it just snapped one day.
Ugh,
and horrible. Somebody was like halfway into the door.
Ugh.
It was it was really creepy. I talked to Steve about it. He was still at Wunderman then.
Really? And so is that what they moved everybody to, like Columbus Circle?
Yeah, I think they're in the AOL building now.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's really creepy.
Yeah, but you ended up being there like
I was there a little over 2 years.
Okay.
And I'm working mostly with Brian Murphy. Brian, if you're listening, he's a really good man. He lives in Ohio now. But yeah, I was there for 2 years, and it was great. Again, it was fun, and the jobs are very similar, you know, like advertising and like television. Like, you just kind of come up with something, you pitch it to a bunch of people, you know. Sometimes it works, sometimes they just stare at you blankly, and then you just go try to produce it, you know. Like, they're very similar. The skills are very similar. Like,
yeah, so you said Allison Silverman knew you from Second City.
Oh, yes, yeah. So how did that work? I read somewhere that Allison was going to be head writer of the Colbert Report, and I think I emailed her, and I said, oh, just when I got picked up, or just when it was announced, I said, hey, Allison, if you're ever looking for somebody, let me know, or something like that. And we were actually in L.A. shooting a commercial for Citibank, and she wrote me, she says, hey, you want to try? I said, okay, and they needed it really fast. It was a really quick turnaround. It was like 3 days, and I was going to be late, and I wasn't going to do it. Maybe we weren't – I'm sorry, I think – we were actually in New York at the time when I heard about this, and I wasn't going to do this. But then one time I went to Starbucks, and Leslie Stahl was there, and I go, oh, it's a sign. I don't know why. I thought Leslie Stahl was a sign. And I said, I want to do this. And so I wrote it, and I wrote a lot of it when we were doing the Citibank ad in L.A. We were only there for like 2 or 3 days. But I remember when they were doing the shoots that I would just type on my computer. And I don't remember it being very good, but I remember it having a lot. It was really fun. And like when I finished, I go, whoa, that was the most fun writing I had in a long, long time. I enjoyed advertising too, but this was like really, I don't know, I just really enjoyed writing this. I sent it off from L.A. While we were still at the hotel for the commercial. And then when we got back, like a day later, it was super fast. And I met with Colbert and Allison and Rich Dom, who used to be the head writer there, or the executive producer there. And, you know, it was a real short interview. It was like 10 minutes. And it was really short, and they asked a few questions, and then I left, and I go, oh, you know, and before I left, I made like a real strong statement. I go, listen, guys, if you give me a chance, kind of like the, you know, the kid that can do anything. I said, if you guys give me a chance, I promise not to let you down. I will try really hard to write every day. You know, like
I will write every day. I love that.
It was like a very Midwestern.
If you hire me, I will do the job that you pay me for.
Yes. I'll do what I am told. But. And I didn't think I got it because the interview was so short, you know. And now I know in hindsight it was so short because, like, it's such a fast turnaround and fast schedule there. Things are always moving. There's always meetings. You know, so there's really no time to just sit down and talk with some people sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But so I left. Like, ah, it was nice. Allison brought me in because she was a friend and that's going to be it, you know. And I go, okay. But then, you know, they called that night and they said, hey, can you start in 3 days? I go, yes, I'll be there. And so that's how that started. But it was really quick and really fast and really unexpected. And, you know, but it worked out well. And everybody was, you know, it was really fun.
Well, how did it feel starting? Because as you said, your first day at Wunderman, you quit. So what's your first day at the Colbert Report
like? Yeah, the first day at Colbert, it was fun. It was different. It's walking in there and like it was really nerve-wracking. Like just because there wasn't that many of us. And I think there was like 5 writers then at the time. And it was kind of nerve-wracking. Like I remember we were in a big meeting. First, you would come in, you're like, Steve is in the room with a bunch of other people, you have production people in there too. And you kind of like throw out your ideas. And I remember I threw out one idea that was really bad. I don't know what it was about. It was about Judy Garland, the Bible. I don't know. Remember what the idea was. But I remember I pitched it really poorly. And Steven just kind of looked at me and he was trying to help me along. And he was still laughing, even though it was a horrible pitch. And I really appreciated that. I go, this guy was trying to help me out, even though I'm bombing a horrible death. And it took me a long time to get used to that. And I used to go home and be really sad, you know, because like I would throw something out in the room and nobody would laugh. I just go, ugh. And it takes you a while to build up that skin and get used to the emotional roller coaster of like throwing things out, you know, and having the bomb and going, okay, I'm going to get back up and try it again. But it took me a while to learn that. And it's still hard to do, you know. So at first, it was hard, you know. Like, and I asked this guy I worked with, Eric Drysdale. He's the guy I first worked with. And he used to be a writer on The Daily Show. And I said, how long did it take you to get used to writing, you know? And he goes, it takes about 2 years. And he was right. It took about 2 years, you know, before I was, like, really comfortable just, like, throwing things out there. And if it died a miserable death in front of the room, I'd go, yeah, who cares? Here's another one, you know.
Right. Now, would you say that's a self-confidence that builds up after 2 years, or is it knowing the room, knowing the show, knowing the staff, or a combination?
I think it's a combination, too. And after a while, I think you kind of get used to the bomb. And, like, and Stephen kind of says this, too. Like, you got to embrace the bomb and appreciate the bomb. And, like, your job is to go out there and feed the beast, you know, add material to the show. And, like, you do what you think is good and say, hey, I believe in this idea. I'm going to pitch it to the room. Like, hopefully you guys, too, and you guys do, too. You know, and I believe enough in it. I'm going to throw it out there. And if it bombs, it bombs. And if it doesn't, well, at least I tried, you know. And, like, I really believed in it. So, like, you really can't be afraid. And you just kind of – and I don't know. You develop a thick skin. And you go, you know what? I really like this. I hope you guys do, too. If you don't, I'll give you something else. And, like, the head writer or executive producer now, Tom Purcell, he says it's like baseball, you know. Like, he gives baseball stats. I don't know the baseball stats. But I think it was, like, you get up to bat, like, 300 times during a year, you know. And, like, sometimes you're going to get a hit, but a lot of times you're going to strike out, you know. And you got the thing is your career. You just got to keep getting up to bat and just keep swinging the bat. And it's very true, you know.
Right. Now, you said they start with 4 or 5. Now, you guys have just wrapped up the show. About how big was the writing staff in the last couple of years?
I think we ended, and I think there was 10 writers. But you have some people at the top, too. You have, like, you have a head writer. You have, like, 2 executive producers, a co-EP who also writes. So I think, like, overall, we ended with 10 writers. I think in there was, like, 12 writers at one point, and then we went back down to 10 writers. And then you have, like, 4 people at the top who writes. And Colbert, you know, who's a writing machine, writes, too. So, like, you know, there's a good handful of people, and there's, like, 10 main writers we ended with. Probably, if you conclude everybody, there's, like, 15 or 16 writers altogether.
Okay. Now, does everybody work on everything? Because Colbert is a show, like a lot of late-night talk shows, where there are broken out bits and there are different types of segments that happen. Was one of them your domain, or is it basically everyone is pitching the word every day? And then everybody's pitching tip of the hat, wag of the finger.
Oh, yeah, you pretty much do everything. Like, it's you just come up with ideas and, like, you pitch them. So you could have an idea for a word one day, a tip wag one day, threat down, cheating death, whatever you have, hometown, hero town, a really seen segment. But, yeah, you just kind of pitch everything, you know, and you really just, like, go through the news of the day and just go, what does this look like, you know, or what slot will this fill? And you go, that's a great idea for this, and you try it that way. But, yeah, it's pretty much every single segment.
Okay. So what was a typical day of the Colbert Report like? Because I remember you saying that there were no shows on Friday, but on Friday you were doing things like writing I Am America and So Can You.
Yeah, when we had the book, you had to do double duty. The book was like, so you write the show like Monday through Thursday, and then on Friday we'd like work on the book, and then we'd also do like on the weekend we'd work on the book. So the book was like a lot of outside work, and then all that was kind of hard. We did 2 books, and it was also kind of trying to write the show and do the book at the same time. So that was a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun, you know, because it's like different type of writing. Like one writing for Stephen's character and the show, but then you also get to write long form for the book, you know, and that was a lot of fun. But that was a lot of work. But the daily schedule was pretty much like let's see. So you get up, you go in, and before you get to work, you kind of like scan the newspaper. Like you go online, look at a bunch of stuff, or if you're in a cab, you kind of look at your smartphone and say like, "Hey, what's in?" You know, look at the headlines and stuff like that. And then you have one meeting, and where everybody kind of throw it, and that's with the head writer, Opus Moreski, and everybody kind of throws out ideas. Like, I like this idea, I like this idea, you know. And then you kind of flesh out the ideas a little bit. Like you throw out a headline, like I don't know, dolphin save swimmer, and so everybody else would kind of add on jokes like, "What if his blowhole?" I don't know, had a life rocket. It's a horrible example and not comedic in any way. But that's sort of the thing. So everybody adds on jokes. And then from there, you go down to the main meeting. And it's another meeting where it's pretty much the exact same thing happens, where Steven's there. We have a bunch of production staff and a bunch of other people there, researchers, what have you. And you kind of Opus will direct people and say, okay, we'll pitch that idea. You head upstairs, pitch that idea. And so you kind of throw out your idea again now. And now, thanks to the first meeting, it's kind of fleshed out a little bit with more jokes. And then, yeah, I'll kind of throw that out there. People add on stuff. And Steven's, you know, a comedy machine. He adds on a lot of stuff too, you know. And then at the end of that meeting, we say, okay, we like this idea, that idea, and that idea. And then usually go off in pairs, which is pretty great to write in pairs because, like, if you're not, you know, Colbert has, like, really tight deadlines and, like, You know, some of these are really intensive stories, you know, where you have to, like, investigate the stories, give the take of the story, you know, do Steven's angle on the story, and then write all that. You usually have, like, 2 hours to do that. So it was really good to have, like, another person there to help you with that. So
now, did you have a regular partner, or would it basically be whatever the pitch was? They would, or would they pick what random? Did you end up working with each other writer one-on-one?
Yeah, usually everybody. I mean, that's the great thing about Colbert, and I think why the staff is so cohesive and we all get along so well is because, like, you do work with everybody. So, like, you always have to be, you know, you work with everybody. So everybody has their own talents, and everybody just kind of get paired up randomly. And it works out really well, you know, because you become really good friends with this person. And it's great, like, go into battle and you say, all right, let's do this. We've got 2 hours. Let's make something, and hopefully you make something, you know. And it's really good that way. So, yeah, it is random, and you pair it up with everybody.
Right. Now what were the things that surprised you? Now, you were there for, what was it, 8-9 years?
Yeah, almost 9 years, yeah.
Yeah, because it would have been running for – it hadn't been running long. I remember when you said you got it.
It came with the 21st show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and now looking back in the old days, like in the early days, you know, when I got there, it's like you could pretty much write anything that morning, and it would pretty much go on the air as is. A few tweaks, you know, but not that many. And then, you know, when we look back 9 years later, it's like – the process was a bit more intensive. That there was a lot more like dollar signing, which is sort of our idea for like when we put a dollar sign by something that was like, oh, you know, try a different joke here or try to punch us up here. So there was more of that toward the later years. But yeah, so in the early years, there wasn't that much rewriting, but definitely more so in the later years. You know?
Right.
And you can see that in the shows too. In the early shows, it's very much like there's comedy and stuff, but it's definitely more attitude, Steven finding the character and everything.
Yeah, it felt more like improv. And I remember reading articles at the time that said the difference between The Daily Show and Colbert is the difference between stand-up and improv.
Yeah, and it's like anything, you know, like any career or anything, like or any show or anything you do, you know, there's like a ramp-up period and a time to find your feet and all that stuff.
Right. Yeah, and I imagine with Steven's voice, that character being so distinctive, it's a voice that pretty much everyone on that show has to share because you're constantly writing through that filter.
Yeah, and that's pretty definitely true. You do have to write through that filter, and that's kind of fun too. I mean, it's fun to have like an anchor like that where you have like, okay, this is the way this character thinks, and it was kind of neat to see the news through that lens. In some weird way, that sort of helps you because, like, you know, again, that horrible example I gave about the dolphin helping the surfer. I mean, you see that through
which Steven, is now recorded.
Which is now recording. But you see that through Steven's lens. You go, what do you think about dolphins? You know, global warming, he probably doesn't want to save the dolphins. So it kind of gives you a take, you know, and it's a fun way to approach stories and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Now, what surprised you the most about doing it over the time? What have you done that you never thought you would do?
What have I done? Oh, my God, there's so many things. I mean, this show has really been like it's fulfilled a lot of creative dreams that I've always had and never thought I would accomplish. And like, I mean, one, we've written 2 books, the show went to Iraq and I got to go to Iraq.
Really?
That was really fun. I mean, that was just great. We flew a big
You're the first human being. I don't know if you're the first human being to ever say it, but you're the first human being that I've ever heard go, I got to go to Iraq. It was really fun.
I don't know why these soldiers are complaining. Like, it is a really great thing over there. No,
I'm taking the kids.
I know. From an entertainment – it was part of a USO show. So from an entertainment USO show, it's pretty fascinating. I assume for the soldiers it's a bit different. But yeah, it was really, really fun and really interesting and great just to see the troops over there and stuff like that. And it was a really fantastic just to put a show. We stayed in Saddam's palace, one of Saddam's wow. palaces. We hit golf balls with the soldiers at night. Like after the show, we'd come back and hit golf balls. I mean, it was a very MASH-like moment, you know, into some like swamp that had some weird carp mutation fish in it, you know. It was just really, really great. You had to wear a flak jacket. I know that sounds really dumb, but that was really
cool. No, that sounds really cool.
And when you go to the bathroom, like soldiers just lay their guns on the, you know, on the sink while they use the bathroom. It was weird to walk into a bathroom and see M16s just laying on the counter. But it was a really fascinating, strange, wonderful experience, you know.
That's
and hopefully we entertained some people. And the troops were great. Like, it was just great seeing the troops, just talking to people. I mean, like, and just, it was a really eye-opening, wonderful experience. And what else have we done? Like, we've done so much with the show. It's, like, written a lot of speeches. I just went to the Kennedy Center Honors with Steven. We just did that. And that was really fun, too. I mean, just to stand in the wings of the Kennedy Center Honors while Steven was the MC of the most recent one. And just to stand in the wings, you know, and see Meryl Streep dancing to Bruce Springsteen while Garrison Keillor, like, looks at his phone. I mean, it was just like an odd, weird experience, but it was really fun.
Yeah, and that's another good point, that Stephen has a guest on every night, so you've gotten to meet all these people that
you hadn't met
before.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I think we have, like, you know, more so than entertainment figures, I think we have, like, a neat roster of, like, authors and politicians and, like, scientists and, like, just historians. Like, it was really musicians. I thought it was a really fascinating mix of the, like, entertainment and also the artistic world, you know what I mean, like, literary world and historical world, I suppose. But, yeah, it was really great. Like, yeah, and just seeing those people. I'm a big, like, Wilco fan, and Jeff Tweedy's been on a few times, and Stephen one time introduced me to Jeff Tweedy, and that was a big highlight. And so, yeah, it was really great that way.
Yeah, yeah, it sounds like I remember the Jeff Tweedy. That was the only time I think you've ever written about the show. Was you blogged it or put it on Facebook?
Yeah, Steve Walsh, who we used to work for. You remember Steve Walsh?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm still friends with him on Facebook, actually.
Yeah, he asked me to write. He has a blog called, like, Rock Turtleneck or something like
that. Yes, yeah, Rock Turtleneck. He's a huge Beatle guy and a Dylan guy.
Yeah, he's a machine when it comes to music. But he asked me to write about the experience because I posted the picture, and I said, all right. So I wrote about the experience for his blog. But, yeah, it was really fun. Yeah. Actually, you should all check out Rock Turtleneck. It's a very good blog.
Yeah, it's a very good blog. Actually, I was freelancing with him downtown when I had my blog going, and he was asking me a bunch of questions about it. And then he just started, and he's one of the few guys still doing it.
I know. It's pretty amazing. I know.
Yeah, we talk a lot about how kind of social media has eaten up the blogosphere to a good amount.
Yeah.
You know, blogs that were just a link or just one line, now you can just tweet those.
Yeah. I know. It definitely has changed. I know.
Yeah. So now, today. In fact, today, as we're recording this, you've announced that Stephen Colbert's CBS show has a premiere date.
Yeah, I think it's September 8th.
Now, is it going to be called The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, or are you guys still thinking about a name?
I know. It's a good question. I mean, if they do know it, I don't know it, you know, but I have no idea, really, actually. That's a good question, and one that the future will reveal to us, but I'm not really sure.
Now, you decided to go with Stephen. How much thought did you give to that?
Well, I mean, he was really nice to, like, bring us over there with him, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel, like, really loyal to Stephen. Like, he's a really good guy and a really good boss. And, like, it's a really great atmosphere over there. It is, like, a very much, like, Wonderman, like, sort of atmosphere over there. And, like, it kind of speaks to his, like, kindness and generosity, the offer to bring us all over there. But, like, there really wasn't much thought, just because, like, I mean, the chance to start up a new show, like, especially the Ed Sullivan Theater, is, like, pretty fantastic. And the chance to work with Stephen again, it would be pretty fantastic. And, like, those people that are on the show already and work with those people again is really fantastic. So it's really, like, a no-brainer, you know, for me. Like, it was like an opportunity to, like, really jump on. Like, it's really great. So,
yeah. Are most people going with you, or is there anybody that's staying for Larry Wilmore in the Minority Report?
I think most people are all going. I know some people are helping out with the Minority Report or the Dan Knightley show, but I'm not sure if they're staying or not. But I think most people are going.
Now with Colbert done and the CBS show not starting until September, mm-hmm. What are you guys doing now? Is this all pre-production and prep work? Are you taking time off?
Yeah, we're actually – I mean, I don't think we're going to start up again until April. So right now, I'm just kind of, like, taking time off. So I have, like, 4 months off and just kind of hanging out and, hanging out with the kids and trying to write some stuff today at jury duty, which is really exciting.
Oh, so that was timed really well then.
Yeah, it was really timed. I forget about jury duty. It really is like the did you see the Hunger Games where they have a big, like, thing they spin and they pull out your name and they announce, like, who has to go to, like, you know, possibly test for these jury panels. It's really scary. Like, I just sit there and just cower. I go, please don't pick me. Please don't pick me. Please don't pick me. And they say, we're going to call 100 people. And I just sit the whole time going, please don't pick me. But it's really nerve-wracking. I have to go back tomorrow, but it's pretty interesting.
Where are you going? Are you in Manhattan? Or
it's Manhattan. So I just go downtown. And yeah, I mean, I just go south.
Yeah, jury duty is scary. Everybody talks about how boring it is, but it's like that whole building is built to be intimidating.
It is weird. It's a very weird process, and it seems like it's just, you know, you have so many people to make a few people. It just seems like a weird – people are expected to spend, like, 2 whole days just, like, hanging out there. It's very strange, but I guess it works sometimes. Yeah,
you're just a living sand in an hourglass in jury duty.
Yes, it's very true.
It's so not about you.
Yes.
I've had it three times. I've never been picked on a jury ever.
Oh, really? Oh, interesting. But I do know some people that have been picked, and they go, I really enjoyed the experience. I go, really? So, I mean, who knows?
I think those are the people that get picked.
Yeah, that's probably...
They're, like, all enthusiastic and asking follow-up questions.
I know, like, I believe it, yeah. I know. People love the justice system. I don't know. Yeah.
People like justice, Mike.
People love justice, yes.
That's why there's a league.
That's true. Yeah, it's very true. You know, speaking of comics, you know, like, I was going to tell you a story about Steven, but, like, I know you're...
Well, he's a huge geek, right?
Yeah, he's a pretty big geek, especially when it comes to Lord of the Rings. That guy, he has so much knowledge of Lord of the Rings. Like, there's one thing that always sticks in my mind. I forgot we were down in his office doing something, and somebody came in and said we need a new dragon graphic or something. I forget what the story was. But Steven goes, oh, you know what I'm looking for? I want the dragon to be sort of like this. There's a Lord of the Rings calendar. It's like 1975, I think it's the March month. I want the dragon to sort of look like that. Like, his knowledge, he has such a, like, a photographic memory when it comes to all things Lord of the Rings. It's really, really impressive. He can quote like crazy, and it's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I just saw the on the extras of The Hobbit.
Yeah.
He had a cameo in the second film,
yeah,
which I missed completely in the theater. But they but they show him like that day in the soundstage, and he's beaming the entire time.
I think it's, you know, a childhood love, and then to get to see it realized on film is pretty incredible for him. And he told the story that he went down there, I guess, to shoot that, and they kind of had like a hobbit off with them and whoever Peter Jackson's like main hobbit guy is that has all the hobbit knowledge, you know, or all the Lord of the Rings knowledge. Mm-hmm. And they kind of had a duel, and I guess Stephen smoked him. Like, wasted this guy that's supposed to be the expert on all things Tolkien. So it's pretty interesting.
Wow. Well, he's not in it.
Yeah.
Where's that?
That's true.
So looking ahead to the CBS show, and I know you said you haven't started working on it, but what's it going to be like to remove that filter of Steven's character? Because Steven's now going to be himself. How are you going to approach writing a nightly show with Steven that's not The Colbert Report?
Yeah, that'll be interesting, you know. But in the past couple of years, really, even since the beginning, like, not every bit has been a political bit. And if you watch, a lot of the stuff can be taken out of the politics and just, like, see Steven having fun and just, like, we have his character on there, but it's loosely political. It's mostly just us having fun and stuff. And I think a lot of that will come through and we'll just do that, you know, like... I assume we'll still discuss politics and still discuss all that stuff, you know, but, like, it just won't be through the lens of this, like, far-right blowhard.
Right.
It'll just be, you know, our Stephen Colbert, like, giving his views on stuff. And I think it will be pretty liberating, actually, and it will give us an opportunity to do a lot more stuff.
Yeah, so you're thinking it'll be a broader show, it'll be freer, there'll be different places to go because you're not tied to that point of view?
Yeah, I think so. And it'll be funny, you know, and then we'll just explore stuff from a different angle, you know. Like, the right blowhard was, like, one way to approach stories. And I feel like not having that will have, like, many more opportunities to approach stories, you know. And I think the, you know, the central factor in the same thing that was at the Colbert Report, which I think will be this show, is just fun, you know. As long as you're having fun and you're enjoying it, I think the audience will too. So,
yeah.
Hopefully that will be the thing that radiates out.
Are you moving into the Ed Sullivan Theater?
Yes, we'll be moving into the Ed Sullivan Theater. I know they're going to do some renovations and stuff, but whenever that's finished, we'll be moving in there.
Well, how do you feel about that?
That's pretty exciting. I mean, like, people have talked about, like, I guess in the basement there's, like, old, like, Beatles and Elvis photos, you know, they're just kind of hanging around. So it'll be really cool just to walk around there and stuff like that, you know.
Yeah, you know about the Muppet Closet?
Uh-uh.
There's a Muppet Closet, and when you find it, you need to take a picture and give it to me. There's a closet. When Jim Henson was on the Ed Sullivan show, they kept getting bumped for rehearsal, and they were sitting in this dressing room all day long.
Yeah.
So they opened the closet, and there were utility pipes.
Yeah.
So they got bored, and they went out for paint, and they Muppetized all the pipes.
That's awesome.
They put, like, googly eyes on there and painted the primary colors and put fringe on there.
Really?
And it's been left alone to this day. I know that Letterman didn't touch it.
Really?
I can't imagine that Colbert will change it. But it's in the building where you work, so I'm giving you a quest.
I accept this quest. I will not let you down. I promise you, I will find that closet and I will send you a photo.
You must find the Muppet Closet. You should ask to put your office in the Muppet Closet.
Oh my God, I would love that so much. That's really wonderful. I had never heard that story. That's wonderful. I can't wait to go look for that.
Yeah, it's in one of the Jim Henson books. There is a picture of it.
Really, that's great. I've definitely searched for that.
Yeah. And the Muppets have been on a lot. I know even Cookie Monster was on the last one.
Yeah, Cookie Monster, Big Bird. I think we had Oscar the Grouch on one time. I think so. But yeah, there's a bunch of writers that are big Sesame Street fans, you know. And so like anytime we could have an excuse to write some Sesame Street bits on, people would bring them up. And like we were fortunate enough to have like, you know, them cooperate. And they were always really great to work with. It's been really fun.
Yeah, I've heard nothing but good stories about them. And they were right in Astoria, which is, you know, my old neighborhood. So
yeah.
That's not much of a commute.
Yeah, it's weird too. Like, I remember, I think when we were having Big Bird set up for the final show, there was like one bit where it's just like Big Bird's legs, just, and then you're, oh my God, this is a pair of Big Bird's legs. It seems so sad. Like, it takes away all your childhood, but it's just interesting. Like, I mean, you know, they're giant puppets, but it's just weird to see them disassembled.
Yeah, they're disembodied anything is disconcerting.
No, just a pair of legs standing alone. I know, it is very weird.
You know what, if you take a gingerbread man and rip off his arms and legs or something, there's something that bothering
true,
about that.
That is true. Well, yeah, that's very true.
And now, all right, this is going to sound like a challenging question, but how many Emmys do you have?
Oh, let's see. We won 4 Emmys.
Okay. And how was that experience?
That's really fun. You know, like we're fortunate to work on a show that has that. You know, it's been really fun. Especially, I think the first time. I mean, the first time is always the most exciting for a lot of stuff. And like, I remember the first time we were nominated. That was really fun. It was my first year there, and we didn't win that year, but it was really exciting just to be nominated and just to go out there. It's pretty great, you know. Like, you go out there, you stay in some fancy hotel in LA, and you put on a tuxedo, you know, and then you ride in a limo to the event. And you walk down the carpet, you know. There's like a carpet for like the main stars, and there's like a side carpet where they just push everybody else down. And so you go down the carpet that you just push everybody else down, you know. And they really move you along. They go, keep on moving. And you want to.
So it's like an airport.
It's exactly like an airport. And you like want to take a photo. You go, hey, there's Melissa Hargitay. And you want to take a photo. They go, move it along. It's like, somebody's trying to stall and take photos of like Melissa Hargitay or somebody. And they're going, move it.
And but so, I'm nominated.
Yeah,
keep going. You'll probably lose.
Yeah, and then you just push you in. And then you go in there. And then it's just like, it's pretty fun. Then you're just like in an auditorium that's just like a sea of stars. I remember first person I remember seeing, I don't know why this stands up, but Ron Jeremy, I think, was the first person I ever ran into.
Why was Ron Jeremy at the Emmys?
That's a very good question. And maybe it wasn't Ron Jeremy. Maybe it was somebody else.
I feel like everything he'd done should not be on TV.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Ron Jeremy. Somebody looked like him, but that was the first.
I'm not disputing it. I'm just wondering how he got in.
No, I agree. I don't know why he was there or why I just managed to see him in the hallway, but it is pretty interesting that you just go like to the bathroom and you go, hey, I'm urinating next to Craig T. Nelson. This is pretty fantastic. And then so it's just like a sea of stars, and then it's pretty fun. And then, yeah, and then you just sit there and you do the ceremony. And I remember the first time we won. It was really exciting running up on stage, and like it really is a great moment. And then we ran out backstage, and you go through the corridors, and you come out, and Mary Hart's there, and she sticks a microphone and going, congratulations, guy. You go, hey, that's Mary Hart. That alone is a great honor just to see Mary Hart. And then it was really fun, you know, it's really great.
I've always wanted to meet Mary Hart. I really have to admit that.
That was my first memory of Mary Hart, but it's really fun. And then, yeah, you take a bunch of photos, and people ask you questions, and then, and then you go to some after party thing. It's really just like a fun, dumb thing, but it is really fun.
That's awesome. And what are you looking forward to most with the CBS show?
You know what? It's like finding it. I'd say I'm looking the most forward to it. I mean, it's kind of neat to start out with a new show and like finding out what it is. And it really is just that, like throwing stuff against the wall and say, let's see what works. Let's see what sticks, you know? And like, and so just kind of creating something out of nothing, you know, and creating something new and just seeing what it is and making our own spin on like with the, you know, the late night arena and all that stuff. I think they'll be really, really fun. And like just to create something new and different and just to have a lot of fun and to work with those people, I think will be really great.
Now, starting out in improv, it's so performing heavy, and you haven't really performed since. Is that something you miss, or are you kind of relieved? Because I know for me, like once I stopped being in the spotlight, I was kind of relieved about it. I was like, I was more interested in writing things and seeing if they worked than getting the attention. Is that how you felt, or do you miss performing?
I miss performing sometimes, but I kind of always like writing more too. You know, like we have a group called Seize the Mustard, which is just the Colbert Report writers, and we do a show at the UCB, and that's a lot of fun. You know, because the bar is so low. Like, I know there's like a level of professionalism usually when you're supposed to do like yes and wait not to walk on and stuff like that, but the bar is so low and it's just like chaos reigns supreme. It's really, really fun, and so that kind of gets the acting out. And dying. And then I
get your last interview on tape then.
Oh, yes, I know. Lucky enough to have it in it. And then I did a character on Colbert I performed one time. I always get really nervous, too, being on camera. Like, I always,
did
like,
you perform on Colbert? I've never seen that.
Oh, yeah. I did this Randy Farrar character who's kind of like just a sleazeball. The HuffPo had an article, Huffington Post had an article about like how college students are warming up to the back door. That was the headline of the article. And they really didn't have a lot of evidence that college students were warming up to the back door. It was just kind of like clickbait. So then I played like the HuffPo editor, Randy Farrar, who was just kind of a sleazeball. And I did a bit with Steven. And then he came back later as a PI in Hawaii. He came back as a private investigator. I think so, as a private investigator or something like that. But it was really fun. And like, you know, Steven's really great about that. Like, you know, he gets the writers to do stuff into bits and characters. So that's been a lot of fun. But yeah, I get really nervous before any acting thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I imagine. Randy Farrar sounds like a Bruce Campbell character.
Yeah.
He's going from sleazy editor to private eye.
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think, it wasn't private eye. It was something like that. I quite forget. Yeah, it does sound like, yeah. This sounds like a hair model for some reason, but yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think I think you're a rarity in terms of entertainment is that you started out at Colbert as a single guy, basically, and now you've got a whole family.
Yeah, I know. That
it seems like the kind of usually that's the kind of thing that destroys families.
I know. It's been pretty fortunate. I know. Like the I know. Like I started dating I was actually supposed to go out with my wife before Colbert. We had like 2 years prior to like Colbert, we were supposed to go on a blind date. Pretty much when I got to New York, but like we were supposed to go on a blind date and I blew her off. And we actually had it arranged and I said, I can't make it. I'm sorry. You know, it's a blind date. So I didn't really feel like going. And then we kind of met up again like 2 years later at a party. And then we said, yeah, we should have went out on that date. And then we eventually went on that date and then magic ensued. But yeah, it all worked out really well.
Yeah. Now you've got two kids. How have the hours been at Colbert? Because I know with some shows like 30 Rock was and Saturday Night Live are notorious for just working into the wee hours of the morning. And as you said, everything's so fast-paced. Do you get home in time to see your kids?
Yeah, you do get – I mean, that's one of the good things about living in Manhattan is like you just like – you know, that I'm fortunate enough to do is just like you can ride your bike home real fast and be home like in 10 minutes, you know, or hop in a cab and be home like in 8 minutes, you know, which is pretty nice. So the hours aren't that bad. Colbert is actually really good about the hours. We have pretty good hours. And it's usually from like – you know, we had – some people would say, you know, 2 days a week you had to stay late, kind of like – you know, help punch up the show right before it went to air, so or right before they taped it. So on your late nights, you probably stay from like 9:30 to like 8 o'clock, and on your early nights, you could like 9:30 to like 6 or 6:30 or something like that. So yeah, you definitely on the later nights you may not see the kids, but on the early nights you saw your kids and like you had the morning with them and stuff like that. So it wasn't as bad as some shows, and it was actually you had like some semblance of family life, which is a rarity in television sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So it's
Are you working?
Go ahead.
Where's in advertising?
What's that?
Are you able to see the kids a lot, or do you have the long hours?
Yeah, no, I'm good. I have like a 45-minute commute. I can usually pick up my second grader before daycare closes. Now, you know, now with the Chicago winter, you never know.
I know. Are you amazed by the Chicago winter? How horrible it is?
I hate it. Every winter, I argue with Renee about how much easier it was in New York in the winter.
It really is. I'm always surprised. It just seems like it gets worse and worse too. Like how horrible.
Well, the planet is getting worse. I mean, you work on a topical show. You know this.
That's true. It seems like Chicago is taking the brunt of all our global warming trouble.
Yeah, because the North Pole is just settling here.
I know.
As soon as I got here, it became the worst it had ever been.
yeah, it is horrible there. Like, it is just, I mean, my wife's from Anchorage, Alaska, actually. I mean, we always have, like, the iPhone weather map, you know? We always, like, let's see Anchorage temperature. And now let's see Chicago's temperature. And Chicago's always so much colder. Like,
than Alaska?
Yeah, it's crazy. Or at least Anchorage. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I will say it's getting to the point now where just all of Chicago is working at home.
I know.
It's like nobody cares if you work at home anymore at any job. Renee got stuck waiting for the train and just came home Friday.
I don't blame her. That's crazy.
No, it's horrible.
Yeah, that is, yeah. But the summer is very nice.
Yeah, but how was New York? I mean, the last time Renee and I came in, we came in like May, and just the gentrification of the city has been like, you know, I was born there and I felt like it felt like an alien place. How does it feel with everything changing around you?
Yeah, it is weird. I mean, like, I guess you're always living it, so you never really like see it. But I guess like, yeah, I think that it is being gentrified, and I think it definitely is. Like, I think De Blasio, the new mayor, kind of ran on like a tale of two cities and like of the rich and the poor. And you definitely see that. I mean, Manhattan especially is all richy rich, and especially Brooklyn now too. Brooklyn is just like crazy. Like, when I came here, it was just like 10 years ago, Brooklyn wasn't that desirable. But now it's like, you know.
Now everybody was living in Brooklyn that, like, Brooklyn was cheaper than Queens.
Yeah, and people wanted to, like, live in Manhattan. But now everybody wants to, like, live in Brooklyn. Like, Brooklyn's, like, the hot spot. And there's awesome places out there, you know. And it's just as expensive as Manhattan. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, I read an article a couple weeks ago that said the two most expensive places to live in America are now Manhattan and Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah, that's more crazy than San Francisco, yeah.
No, that's crazy. You know, Astoria, they always say, is next, too. They always say Astoria is the next place to go.
Yeah, I was seeing Queens, and that's like every time I get frustrated about Chicago winters, I'm like, we should just go back to Astoria. Then I see these prices, and I'm like, I don't think we can.
I know. It's crazy. It's really, yeah. It seems like everything, like, at a certain point, like, I think, what's his name? I'm forgetting his Robert Reich. Is that his name? He has some theory about, like, how sooner or later, the rich has to, like, turn the taps. And I think Steven talks about this sometimes. But, like, how you can't, like, it just seems like something's got to give after a while. And it does seem like, I don't know what it's going to get, but it just seems like you can't have this crazy wealth disparity where things keep going up and up and up and up. But who knows
what. Right, yeah, we're definitely getting to, like, this dystopian future.
I know, it is crazy, I know. Like, but, yeah, who knows what will happen, but, yeah. But, yeah, Manhattan's crazy, gentrified. I mean, Brooklyn's crazy. Yeah, it is kind of crazy now.
Yeah, so how long are you guys in Manhattan, you think, for the long haul? Or do you think about, like, getting a house?
Yeah, we always think about it. It depends, like, you know, with kids. We have another kid, you know, we'll probably go move up to, like, Dobbs Ferry, which is sort of like the suburbs, you know, like a half hour away. Or it just depends, like, we have two kids, maybe we'll try to stick it out. Because the great, like we said, like, the good thing about Manhattan, like, where we live, is that you can't actually get home to see the kids and put them to bed, you know? And so, like, it's kind of worth putting up with, like, a smaller house and, like, a small room and the occasional rat in the backyard as long as you can see your children. So we'll see what happens. Who knows? But for right now, we're going to stick it out here.
Yeah. So now that I know you've been with Colbert so long, and I know there have been a lot of writers that have come through, and I know there have been guys like Peter Gross, who we both know, who've gone on to become performers. Is there anything you still want to do? Obviously, you're going to a major network talk show. That's a huge thing. But is there anything that you're thinking in the back of your mind? Is there a novel? Is there a screenplay? Is there a sitcom you've always wanted to pitch?
Yeah, I think all that, you know. I think, like, you probably know this too. It's just like, or with music or with comics or with anything, you know, like, once you have, like, the bug to do something, you just, like, find excuses to do it, you know. And so, like, I always think, I'd like to, like, write narratively, you know, try a sitcom and, like, try it, you know, and you're right, like, a book and, like all those things you just mentioned, like a screenplay, you know, and I've tried my hand at some of that stuff and it's all pretty fun, you know, like, especially, like, sitcom. I just, like, it's almost fun now just to write sitcom pilots. It's just, like, you know, they're, like, 32 pages, 33 pages, and they're just kind of fun to, like, churn out and, like, develop characters and have, like, little stories, you know, like, so I really enjoy that and, like, maybe one day trying that, you know, but our movies too, you know, and, like, I'll try it, you know. But for right now, I'm really happy doing, like, you know, what I'm doing and stuff.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. I know that was a weird answer, but yes.
Yeah. What was your I'm running out of questions. But
That's all right.
Dude, what was your favorite thing that you've written? I mean, it could be a team effort, but what's what's the one thing that when it was on the air, you were like, okay, this one is what I'm going to remember?
There's two things I just remember just because they were really new. And the first one was Steven's idea. It was like, it was really early on the show. I think it was 2005. It was like, I Have a Creamsicle. It was kind of like a parody of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, but it was like, I Have a Creamsicle. And it was Steven's idea, and I wrote it up. But it was just really fun, and the audience responded really well. And I was really proud about that because it was one of my, you know, the early successes. And then I had this idea, like, Bill O'Reilly got into a shouting match with David Letterman. And I said, oh, Steven, you should do a similar thing maybe with Conan O'Brien. And Steve goes, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. So, like, that night, me, Allison Silverman, and Steven went in a town car. And, you know, I've never really been in a town car. So just to be in a town car was pretty exciting with Steven and Allison. We rode over to Conan. And I was always a big fan of Conan. And this was, like, 2005, too, I think, or maybe early 2006. But, you know.
So, yeah, so it's pre-Tonight Show. It's still the 12:30 show for him.
Conan's late spot. We went over there and. You know, it was after Conan's taping, and he was really nice, and I talked to Mike Sweeney and shook his hand. I'm a big fan of all those guys, especially Conan, and Conan was really nice. And I remember talking about him and his wife, who was in advertising for a little bit. I'm like, I can't believe I'm talking to Conan about his wife working in advertising. And then we filmed this bit where Steven insults Rosa Parks, and then Conan shoots Steven, or is it vice versa? But one of those happened. And that was really fun, just to have, like, an idea, and then to actually go over and do it that night was really crazy, you know? And, like, being a big Conan fan, a big Steven fan, and to see those worlds collide, I was really, really happy with it. That was, like, a big, nice New York TV moment that I was really happy with.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's going to continue because, you know, now you have, especially with Fallon staying in New York, you have these four shows, five if you count SNL. You have these four huge late-night shows all still in New York.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see. Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens and everything. But, yeah, it is like a lot. Yeah, New York really is like the late-night capital. I know there's like a lot of late-night shows here.
That's why there's only rich people there. Because they're all working on a late-night show.
That's true. That's very true. Yeah. It will be interesting to see like the new future landscape of television. I mean, so much is changing, too, with like Netflix and Amazon and all that stuff. So Hulu.
Right, yeah. You don't have to have a network anymore.
Yeah, it's an interesting moment in television, you know, like, so we'll see what the future holds for all these shows. The future.
Now, Mike, do you use Twitter? I know we're Facebook friends, but do you use Twitter a lot? Do you use Instagram? Are there places where people can find you?
Yeah, Instagram, I do Instagram, and then I do Twitter, but I'm always really bad about that stuff. I should be really good about that. I don't know why I'm not, but yeah, so not really.
Maybe because you're writing things that appear on television.
Yeah, also just probably out of pure laziness, too. I don't know. It's harder with the kids, you know. Like, I get home, like, ah. But, yeah, or, like, people don't probably just want to see pictures of my kids on Instagram.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so, yeah, not really.
Do you want to tell people what your Instagram is?
No, there's really no reason. I'd just be disappointed. And I would see pictures of my daughter eating brownie batter. It's not that exciting. But they're wonderful children.
Yes. I love this. This ends with like an anti-plug.
No, there are some great other people you can follow on Instagram and Twitter that are really creative, that have wonderful things to say. I unfortunately do not, but there's some great people out there.
Oh, Steven's got a good Twitter feed.
He does. Follow Steven's Twitter feed. He's Steven at home. Really funny. You should follow that one. And who else? Peter Gross, we just mentioned. I know. Yeah.
Yeah, Peter's great.
Yeah, you know, Peter, the great thing about Peter is that he, you know, I always talk about, like, when it comes to writing, like, some people are really good about, like writing stuff and it doesn't go well. They just go, all right, on to the next thing, you know? And, like, I'm always really bad about that. Like, if I don't, something doesn't go well, I go, ah, it hurts. I feel bad about myself. Like, Gross was like, he's so great about, like, writing something, it doesn't work. He goes, okay, on to the next thing. That's a great attitude to have, you know? I always really envied him for his attitude. He was able to do that.
Yeah, he really gave you a great compliment once, and I don't know if it's going to totally throw your self-esteem out of whack by telling you. But remember, Mike Drucker and I used to run that show at the People's Improv Theater. We used to have that show, Writer's Room. I remember asking you if you wanted to come on a few times. But I got to know Peter because he would come on that show. And he and I were talking about Colbert, and I said, "Oh, I said you're a friend of mine, and you're on there." And he said, Mike has no idea how good he is.
Oh yeah, that's nice of him to say.
It's nice of him to say. I think you can take it on that level.
Yeah, he's a good guy. Gross is a really good guy. Very,
I was just binge watching Veep I was catching up on that.
Yeah.
And he's popped up on there, yeah. And he's the Sonic guy.
Yeah, he is. I know. He's all over the place. It's not, I know. Yeah, he's on late night with Seth Meyers now. He's a writer on Seth Meyers.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, he's great. He's great.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah. So anyway, follow Peter Gross's Twitter and Instagram feed. He's a very talented man. He really is. Yeah.
Are there other people you should recommend that aren't you?
Let's see. Other people. Yes, there are many. Just Twitter is a wonderful universe of creative. You know who's really good, actually? Dan Guterman. He was writing on Colbert, and now he writes for Community. But the man's, I wish it was mine, but you follow Dan Guterman on Twitter. He's really, really creative. Super hilarious. One of the nicest and funniest guys I know. But you should all follow Dan Guterman.
Yeah, Community's exactly what we were talking about, because there's a show that was Network, and now it's going to be Yahoo, who right now doesn't do any original programming.
I know, that's crazy. That'll be interesting to see how that plays out, but yeah, Yahoo, I know.
Yeah, and last night, as we were recording this, the Golden Globes were last night, and it was streaming was sweeping. You know, Jeffrey Tambor won, and Kevin Spacey won, and all for shows that are not on television.
Yeah, I know. It really is a different time, and like, I had lunch with this guy the other day, Phil Rosenthal, who writes for he was like the head guy of Everybody Loves Raymond.
And, yeah, he created it, didn't he?
Yeah, he created it. And he was saying, like, oh, you know, networks, it's just weird. I mean, he was just saying, like, how, like, he doesn't, you know, it's almost beneficial not to work for network anymore. You know, it's so much easier to do these other routes besides network. So it really is like a weird changing time in television, you know. It's kind of an interesting moment in TV.
Yeah, it's almost like music 10 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Except less volatile. Yeah. They didn't take the industry with it.
I know. I love Spotify so much, but every time I listen to it, I always feel so bad. I go, but it's destroying the music industry. But it's so convenient and so wonderful.
Well, really, the music industry was destroyed before Spotify.
Yeah.
I don't think you should feel bad when you BitTorrent something.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. Do not BitTorrent any. Do not pop the time any movies.
That's the one recommendation you won't give. You won't say.
Do not.
You know, it's really great BitTorrenting. Everybody should go and.
BitTorrent, popcorn time, do not. No, it is convenient. It is horrible. Yeah. But yeah. I know, but yeah, it's a good. Yeah, it's all good, you know, and I'm really fortunate to, you know, just to like, you know, harness myself onto somebody like Steven, you know, and he's been really, really great to work for, and an all around good guy. And like, it's just an honor to work for him and stuff like that. So,
yeah, that's fantastic. And I like that you have a few months now to kind of spend time with your family and think about it. It's going to be very interesting in April when you get back together and figure out what the show is.
Yeah, it'll be fun. I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to it. In fact, I just got an email from one of the guys today, and he was just saying, like, I can't wait to get back to work, you know. We've only been out of work for a few weeks, but he's going, I can't wait to get back to work. And, yeah, I kind of feel the same way, too. I'm really excited to see, like, what the next chapter is and how it all comes together.
You can follow me at Not In My Book on Twitter. That is the Caffeinated Comics Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook. A lot of things going on Facebook. And Steven's shop is 19 South LaGrange Road in LaGrange, Illinois. We will talk to you next week.
Caffeinated Comics is a Not In My Book production.
Take that!